Greetings from Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. As we record this podcast, I recognize and acknowledge that I'm located on the traditional territories of the Mississauga and Haudenosaunee nations and within the lands protected by the Dish with One Spoon Wampum Agreement. I am Selina Mudawanu.
Greetings from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. I would like to take this opportunity to acknowledge the traditional territories of the people of the Treaty 7 region in southern Alberta. The city of Calgary is also home to Métis Nation of Alberta, Districts 5 and 6. I am Motilola Akinfemisoye Adejare.
Welcome to the Black Professors Podcast.
Selina and I are faculty members who are trained in media and communication studies.
And we worked in radio and television broadcasting at some point in our careers.
Our interests include digital storytelling, radio, and alternative media forms. On the podcast, Black professors will be asked about their pathways into academia and how they found themselves in their areas of specializations. They will also be asked to talk about the political, social, and other contexts that impacted their decisions to enter academia.
Further, they will be asked to share stories about their research and teaching trajectories, high and low lights in their careers, awards and grants they won, courses they developed, as well as their current research and teaching interests.
These professors will be invited to give advice to young people in Black communities and to their early career colleagues on successfully navigating the academy.
The professors will also be requested to speak about their favorite foods, hobbies, holiday destinations, as well as how they endeavor to maintain the work-life balance.
Dr. Julia Daniel is an esteemed biology professor and strategic advisor to the president for the Canada Caribbean Institute, CCI, at McMaster University. She's distinguished in her field for pioneering research in cancer biology, specifically on the transcription factor, CAISO, coined from her favorite Caribbean music, Calypso, and its role in triple negative breast cancer.
Her work has been acclaimed as transformative in the field of cancer biology as it aims to uncover novel cancer therapies. Dr. Daniel is also the co-founder of the Canadian Black Scientist Network. She's a major advocate for diversity in the STEM field. She is a co-founder of the African Caribbean Faculty Association of McMaster and an active mentor for African and Caribbean students at McMaster University and in the larger GTA community.
Dr. Daniel has been awarded numerous accolades, including her nomination into the Canadian Academy of Health Sciences and being named as one of the 100 accomplished Black Canadian women. Dr. Daniel is also passionate about community initiatives that aim to promote health education and overall well-being for marginalized communities. She's also passionate about dancing. We're so excited to have Dr. Daniels with us on the podcast today.
Dr. Daniel, welcome to the podcast. What kind of music do you like dancing to?
So thank you very much for having me on your podcast today. I love dancing to anything with a rhythm. So my favorite music is calypso, Latin salsa type music. I love Afro beats. I like reggae. Anything that is going to keep me moving and, you know, cause a little sweat to break out, and just also something that's joyful and uplifting. But I also like the classical dances such as the Viennese waltz and the foxtrot. I actually took Latin and ballroom dancing since I was a graduate student. I started by mistake. I went to the wrong dance class, but fell in love with it and stayed. And so I danced for over, I don't know, what is that, almost 15, 20 years. I did ballroom and Latin dancing. And I actually won 2 top female awards for Latin dancing, ballroom and Latin dancing. And I did ballroom and Latin dancing for my first 7 years at McMaster. It's fantastic therapy for any junior faculty listening. I highly, highly recommend it, because for the entire hour that you're dancing with your instructor, you can think of nothing else. Because all you're thinking about is, where do I put my feet? Where do I put my hand? How do I stay upright and like keep my body tone? And it's seriously one of the best. I think it is an excellent therapy, because you're getting exercise as well as that mental break from all the stresses and craziness of the day. And your dance instructor is a nice objective person to vent to about all the nonsense that's going on. And they... it's confidential, because who are they going to talk to about what you went through as an academic, right? So I would highly recommend it to any junior faculty member to take ballroom and Latin dancing lessons. Definitely spared my life.
That's awesome. So Dr. Daniel, have you always wanted to be a professor then?
I didn't necessarily always want to be a professor, but I did want to do research that would have global impact. I grew up in the dinosaur era, as my students like to call it, when we didn't have computers or cell phones. All we had was Encyclopedia Britannica and a paperback world atlas. And the news. And so I wanted to do something with global impact, but I didn't know the path or the trajectory to become a professor per se. But once I got into graduate school and started learning about different career options, the academic path sounded interesting, even though I wasn't too keen on the publish or perish, write grants aspect of it. But once I pursued my postdoc, I chose academia because of the freedom that it gives, the freedom to work whatever hours you wish, when you wish, and consequently the freedom to take your holidays when you're not teaching, whenever you wish. And I had friends that went straight into industry, and their lives were a lot more restricted. And so that's when I realized that 12 years of being a grad student and a postdoc with the freedom to work whenever I wanted, I didn't think I could give that up to go to a 9-to-5 job.
How do you prevent yourself from overworking?
I'm not sure that we overwork unless you're not exercising. If you're not exercising and doing something fun, then you are overworking. But as I said, like, I've always had exercise as part of my, I would say, my daily regimen. And my students know that. So actually pre-pandemic, I always took a break around 4:30, and I would go to the gym and work out for an hour. Then I'd have dinner, and then I might work 2 or 3 hours after. Most people would probably just keep working right up till 8 or 9 o'clock. So I don't think it's overworking, as long as you might have longer days, but as long as those days are spliced with exercise or spending time with family or friends, I don't see it as a longer day than the average person. It's just that we break it up into times that's more beneficial or practical for our individual personalities and styles, right? Like, I have friends who will leave work at 4:30, and then they'll go pick up the kids, take the kids to soccer, give the kids dinner, put them to bed. And some of them go to sleep early with the kids and then wake up at 4 a.m. and work. So I think if we added up the hours, yes, I think professors do work a little longer than most other professions, but we're not working like 24 hours a day. We just control the time that we work, which is what I love, as I said, that flexibility to do that. And especially as women, if you have a family, like, that's one of the biggest, I think, benefits of being a professor. You can actually have that career and family, and because of that flexibility that it affords you. Whereas in other professions, that you have to leave at 4:30 or 5. And like, the kid's sick, you can't even go home and you have to take a half day off work. Whereas for us, we could go pick up the kid and then work from home later, and it's okay. Like, so I think that that's, for me, one of the biggest, the flexibility really is the biggest selling point for academia.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for sharing those very insightful points. Lots of things to still ask later about what it means to be a woman in academia, because that's a whole PhD thesis by itself.
Yep.
Yeah. So when you were in secondary school, what did you study and how did that shape your future career as a professor?
So I would say, so in secondary school in Barbados, I was, all round student. So I loved the arts. I loved coloring and drawing. And my entire family, extended family, is artistic. We have a very artistic streak in our family. You know, my dad was a cabinet maker. So he made antique style furniture out of mahogany. One of my aunts was a seamstress professionally. The other one made what we would call back in the day a haberdasher. So she made hats and bags. My other uncles made furniture. So the whole, and then I had cousins that were like fine art artists kind of thing. And so I was good at everything. And I would say the turning point to becoming a scientist was when one of my English literature teachers did not like my interpretation of Shakespeare. And I was already a critical thinker. And so when the question said, what do you think Shakespeare meant? To me, it meant, what do I think? And so she wanted the answer for what Mr. Cole, who wrote Cole's Notes, thought about Shakespeare. And I wrote what I thought Shakespeare was. And so that's when I realized that I was never going to get an A in her class. And so I decided to focus on the sciences, where 1 + 1 was always 2 and E is always MC squared. And not based on her opinion versus mine. And that also became my epiphany later in life when I realized how much impact our teachers have on our futures. Because I genuinely loved everything and I was good at everything. But my interpretations of Shakespeare was not valuable to her. Yeah. So that really changed my, you know, options. And it's made me wonder about how many other students and youth have been negatively impacted by their teachers, but didn't have a family or the critical thinking for themselves to realize that it wasn't them that was the problem, that it was the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think there's something to be said about how to give feedback to students in ways that, you know, build them up instead of discourage them. Yeah,
exactly. Or even just acknowledge, okay, Juliet, I hadn't thought about it that way. But now that I read your, you know, that's an interesting perspective. And I'll, you know, this is creative. I'll still give you an 8 because it's creative. Just like whatever Cole said is the only answer.
But I'm glad STEM benefited because we are going to talk later about the amazing accomplishments that you have gone on to achieve. And so when did you come to Canada? You said you are from Barbados. You grew up at least in Barbados. When, at what point did you come to Canada?
So I came to Canada after I completed my A-levels in Barbados. I was a bit of a unicorn in my neighborhood. And so my family knew from a very young age that I was different. I was the kid that was always reading, asking the why questions, very studious, and, you know, getting A's. And so they saved as much as they could. And I had the option to stay in Barbados or go overseas. And I chose to go overseas because, as I said, I always felt I had this bigger worldview, even at a young age. And so I went to Queen's University for my bachelor's with the goal originally to do life sciences and then become a doctor. So I was enrolled in the life sciences program at Queen's, which was an incredible program at Queen's. Still in touch with many of the students that was in that class. It's a lot smaller than the McMaster Life Sciences program, which is a very huge program. At Queen's, it's more similar to our Arts and Science program, 60 students. But unfortunately, my last year of undergrad, my neighbor died of breast cancer in Barbados. My mom was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. And then my mom died 4 days before I graduated from Queen's. So all of that then led me to decide, okay, I don't really want to be a doctor per se. I want to do the research that can find the treatments or the cures for cancer, because the doctors were clearly unable to save my mom and my neighbor. And I felt, and part of that was due to the lack of therapies really for, at the time there were therapies for breast cancer, and I don't remember how long my neighbor in Barbados had breast cancer and what therapy she had, because I was only 19, 20 at the time, and I didn't know the kind of questions to ask about the treatments, right? But definitely I know for ovarian cancer, there was no treatment. And even now it's still challenging to treat ovarian cancers, and they have one of the highest mortality rates still. That whole phenomenon in my last year of undergrad led me to choose research instead, where I felt I would have a bigger impact by finding a drug or a target for a drug or something along those lines. So, yeah.
Thank you for sharing that. And it's so exciting to hear that, that your desire to want to change that came from a place of pain. And thank you for sharing those insights. Very, very, very useful. I was wondering too, added to that, the pressure of moving to a new country, having to adjust and make new lives. What was that experience for you like moving to Canada?
It was bittersweet, I guess. It was a combination of, you know, you're leaving the beautiful sunny island with really good food and music and also a culture where you didn't think about race or color because the majority of the people were Black. And so there's that. And then at the same time, it's like a whole new world is opened because definitely growing up, there were only so many types of restaurants in Barbados. Like I think we maybe had Chinese and maybe Italian and then tons of Caribbean. And then you come here, it's like, what? There's Greek food? Oh my goodness, what is that? What's Portuguese food? Like, you know, suddenly you're exposed to all these different cuisines and, you know, all these different types of theater and the arts. And as I said, it was this very strange, bittersweet, interesting phenomena because as someone that had loved reading and was always immersed in books and dreaming of what I was reading in a book, suddenly now I'm getting to experience it firsthand. But by the same time, I'm missing my family and friends. There was no computer. You had to save your money to phone home, and then it would take forever for the call to go through. And then you'd have 10 precious minutes to talk, you know, and you write a letter. It would take 3 weeks to get there. And then it will take them 3 or 4 weeks to reply. So you wouldn't be in touch with people for 8 to 9 weeks. So you had to learn to make friends. You had to grow up basically and be independent because you didn't have that safety net of calling your parents to help you 5 times a day, like some of our students do right now, right? Like you had to learn to make decisions for yourself and develop those critical thinking skills on your own. So as I said, it was a very interesting time and I definitely had to grow up quickly. But I enjoyed it. Many of my international student friends and I started describing ourselves as living in no man's land. Once you've left somewhere and lived somewhere else, especially as a younger person, you are now a mix of those two communities. Mm-hmm. And so you fit into neither one. If someone has only lived in Canada or only lived in the Caribbean or only lived in Africa, that's all they know.
Yes.
Now, we've got that experience of both cultures. We're not saying that we're better. We're just saying that we're different and we understand multiple perspectives now and it's really shaped us. And for some people, that's hard to understand.
Yes. And I hear you loud and clear. It reminds me of one of the classes I teach where I ask my students, it's on the African diaspora and the Black diaspora. I say, where are you from? Where is home? Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be an easy question. It ends up being the most difficult question in that class because where are you from? And what does home mean? Because you're making home where you are, taking experiences from different places. You spoke about Portuguese food, Greek food, and you find yourself loving some Greek food because it's similar to something you know from somewhere. And you taste it and you're like, why does this feel familiar when it's so strange? What's going on?
Exactly. Yeah.
It's a very interesting feeling that people have when they move places. And it's what, like you said, makes us very different and unique and have this splendid experience that makes us able to fit in and flow wherever we find ourselves.
Exactly. Which is why I try to encourage students to really travel and to live somewhere, not just on vacation, but try living somewhere because it changes everything. It changes how you think of the world and how you think about other people, right? Because you can't think the same way about people once you've lived with them for a while. You just can't.
I have to ask this question. As somebody who grew up with amazing weather in Barbados and now faced with a Canadian winter, how did you cope?
The first year, you know, you're 18, so it's all fun, right? It's like, oh, snow. I still remember my first time seeing flurries. I think I thought it was the ash from a building on fire because it was like the first night of our first midterm in undergrad, and we went to a bar to celebrate first year students. We're like, yay, we survived our first midterm. And this stuff was coming down. And I was like, what's going on outside? Is that ash from a fire or something? And all the Canadians started laughing and they're like, no, that's so like I still vividly remember the bar, everything. So I would say the first year you're like, it's exciting, right? And then there's like, wow, you can buy special boots and they're so cute, and you can buy a jacket. Like the first year is like, it's just fun, right? Because it's different. But then it's like, oh, this is so cold, I hate this. And you're slipping and you're falling. And but the first year was, to me, it was literally, I literally saw moving to Canada as an adventure. And again, I think coming with the right mindset makes a complete difference to how you settle in. So I came with, this is a giant adventure. My parents are giving me a privilege, and I was just soaking it all in. I was like, bring it on, just give it to me. I just want to soak this in. So it was just, for me, it was an adventure. But then, as I said, the reality was after that, I'm like, okay, where's the warmest part of Canada? Vancouver. I'm going to grad school. Like, I was fed up with the snow after 4 years. So,
That's so awesome to listen to. And you just saying it's a big adventure. I think that's a great way to think about it, having fun, but also doing this amazing work that you do. Speaking about your research, what's your current research and how has that evolved over time?
So it's right now we have, well, actually three main projects in the lab. I don't talk about all of them a lot. Most people know about the work we're doing on triple negative breast cancer and Black women, as it disproportionately affects Black women, although we have a lower overall incidence of breast cancer, but we seem to have a higher prevalence of triple negative breast cancer in Black women and communities. So that's, I would say, our biggest funded project. But we're also looking at KYSO, the gene that I discovered. We're looking at its roles as well in colon cancer, because that's actually how I started my lab, was looking at KYSO in signaling pathways in colon cancer. And then the breast cancer project literally popped up about 12, 15 years ago. And then a third project is looking at the role of KYSO in normal human development and developmental disorders. So many of the pathways that regulate how our cells work and how our organs work are the same pathways, when they malfunction, give rise to cancer or developmental disorders like autism or other developmental disorders. So it turns out that KYSO and many proteins that are structurally similar to KYSO play roles in human vertebrate development. And so we've got an exciting project that I haven't spoken to about much because we haven't been funded for it yet, and we haven't published anything yet, but we've got this exciting project happening on the side that one day we're hoping is going to be like, psh, yes, and complement the cancer research.
Great work. And how challenging or easy is it to find funding for your work?
It's funny you should say that, because the CHR results just came out and people are all online talking about 15% success rate. Why are we saying 15% success? And no one ever says, but really, that means 85% failure. 85% of our biomedical researchers did not get their grants. 85% of the labs in Canada are now not funded. Like, right? And so anyway, that's going on right now online. And so it's hard, and it's something that even as a junior faculty member, I thought we need to stop doing things the way we've been doing for 100 years and revisit how we do things. 100 years ago, when all of our current systems were set up, things were very different. And we've evolved in different ways. We have phones, we have computers, but our systems aren't evolving as quickly as technology and some of the other things we do. And so I would love a system. This is just one idea. I would love everyone to throw their ideas out, and then our agencies, tri-council agencies, come up with a better version of all of these ideas. But I think we're all hired as professors because the university saw something in us. They think we're valuable. Why do we then have to keep writing grants to justify our existence, right? You've hired us, you've given us a salary, we're teaching full time. We should all have a baseline funding to do research. And then if your research requires more money, then you apply for a grant, rather than everyone has to apply for a grant all the time. It would cut down on the work that many of us have to do. We would actually be able to focus and do the research instead of writing grants to do research that we don't get, and then writing more grants, which takes away from doing the research, right? So I would love us to think about that. But it's been challenging, especially for the disparities research on triple negative. When I first submitted that grant in Canada, one of the reviewer's comments was it wasn't relevant to the Canadian context, studying breast cancer in Black women. And it really saddened me because, one, I was a Black woman, and at the time I was also a breast cancer survivor. And I'm like, but we have Black women in Canada, so, and at least a billion in the whole world. So, like, that comment really was quite disturbing. But it showed me as well how racism and discrimination was existing even in academia and our funding agencies. Yeah.
My question really is to, you know, you are a professor of high standing. You know this research and you've been doing it for a while. What advice would you give to your early career colleagues on how to deal with this funding rejection?
I would say, so again, I am a unicorn in many, many ways. So unlike most people, I actively seek criticism. So from, and I guess maybe because of how I was trained as well. So I had very, very critical supervisors and co-supervisors, like we're talking. You had to develop a thick skin very, very early, and or you wouldn't make it, especially in STEM, some STEM professions. And so from very early, all of my mentors told me, like, the first of all, they were there for me. So my very first grant, I had, I don't know, 5 or 6 people reviewing my grants from all over the world, that had people that had mentored me or that I met and that I clicked with. So you first need to find people that genuinely care about your success, not just the most famous person, because chances are they've got lots of other people banging at their door, but find people that care about your success. So all the people that wrote my reference letters for my faculty position, every one of them wrote and gave feedback on my very first grant application because they wanted me to succeed, right? They wrote my reference letters for me to get the faculty position. Now I have the faculty position. They want me to succeed. So all of them read and gave feedback on all of my, I would say, grants for the first 5 years. And then once I was established more in Canada and I made a bigger network, then I would ask colleagues that I knew in Canada or other places as well. So every grant that I write, historically, I would get 7 or 8 of them to review my grants. And I gave them carte blanche to make it as read as they wanted, because I preferred the criticism before I submit than after and get a rejection letter. And it's hard because some people take it very personally when they see all the red ink. And so the more criticism you get before it's submitted and the feedback, the better it's going to be, because then you have the funding to do the research that you want to do instead of spending the time for the next year writing the grant again and feeling dejected, right? Like, so it's like, it's learning to do that, I think. And it's tough because for some people, they take it very, very personally. And you have to detach yourself and say, wait a minute, this feedback is going to help me make the proposal that much stronger. It's going to make me think about all the caveats I hadn't thought about, because these people are not as attached to it as I am. And so they can see the weaknesses, they can see the flaws. They can also see the strengths, and they'll point out, this part is great, highlight this more. This part is weak, take this out. Like, they, if they care about you, they will give you honest and frank feedback coming from a place of caring, not a place of bringing you down. So, yeah.
Find people that care about your success. Those are words on marble. Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing those. And moving to teaching, what is your teaching philosophy?
So I haven't taught now for 4 years because I've been in an admin role. So what's my teaching philosophy? Again, I think I've always tried to get the students engaged and love science as much as I do. But I also want them, again, because the world is so different to when I was an undergrad student, I also want them to be thinking about the world, the geopolitical systems, everything that's happening and how it's going to impact what they're learning and the careers they're choosing. Because especially in STEM, so many students come in just wanting to be physicians. They can't all be physicians, and they don't have a backup plan. They haven't even done any research on alternate careers. So I always dedicated 1 lecture per course just to talk about careers. I don't talk about any data or information on science. The entire lecture is focused on alternate careers, knowing yourself, all of that, those kind of, so it's more like a mentoring lecture that I give in every course. And I think we should all have one class per term focused on that for all of our students, because they really, unfortunately, are not listening to the news as much as we think they should. they really don't have that worldview that we would love them to have. And I think part of our job as professors is to teach them to love what we love, but also to teach them how to navigate this world better or differently, because it is more challenging now than it was for us. And we have to help them in as creative ways as we can, while still getting them to love academia, still love learning, and not wanting to take the shortcuts or to cheat, which is unfortunately on the rise. So,
yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for sharing that. And of course, many things to think about in how we teach right now. But when asked to develop a course, where do you usually start?
Well, the good thing in science and STEM, we're pretty collegial that way. So if unless it's a brand new course, if you're taking over, usually you're taking over a course from someone. And so we share those slides. So like someone has taken over my course, I will give them all my slides, so they don't have to reinvent the wheel from scratch. And then they can go through and say, nah, I don't feel like teaching that. So we don't start from scratch unless it's a brand new course that no one's taught before. In which case you then have to think about, okay, what do I want the key points of this course to be? What do I want the students to learn and why? And then you go from there. But I would say in STEM, some of it's very prescriptive because they have to learn some of the fundamental things about physics or chemistry or math or biology. And so those don't change. The fundamentals don't change. It's the senior level courses that might evolve a bit more. And many of our creative, innovative instructors always try to bring in real world, real life scenarios to help the students learn about the subject matter in a practical way. For those of us that need that anyway, some people can just memorize. Some of us need to see, how does this help me pay my bills? Or how is this relevant to catching the bus or going to the doctor? Like whatever, like you just have to make it relevant. Yeah. And so I would say that's how we approach it. Yeah.
And in terms of teaching in a world that now has artificial intelligence, how do you think about artificial intelligence in terms of teaching and learning?
Yeah, that one's a challenge, and it's going to be interesting and hard to navigate. And it's funny because I was in South Africa in 2019 for my as part of my research leave, and I got roped into at the very last minute a panel discussion about the fourth, what was it called? The fourth revolution.
Industrial and the fourth revolution
was about artificial intelligence and all this stuff. And I was like, I don't know. But it was a really fascinating panel discussion. And now here we are, less than 5 years later, right? And it's here. And I think when we did that in 2019, a lot of the people that were calling in or discussing were like, no, that's will never happen. And I think it shows that if we're not keeping up with what's happening globally, we're going to get left behind. Mm-hmm. And that's not just it. So from an individual level, from a country level, like we just need to be aware. But we also have to have checks and balances in place so that, as we say, the horse doesn't get out the barn too early, because it's really hard to pull it back. And I think that's what's happened with artificial intelligence. So much of this has happened already, ChatGPT, et cetera, and there were no accountabilities or gatekeepers to make sure that they were designed in the best way possible. And now we're having to backtrack and say, okay, we need this.
Mm-hmm. That's something to stick with, and that we'll constantly be thinking about.
Exactly.
You know, mentioning the fourth industrial revolution. I was in Botswana at the time, so I know it was a big deal in Southern Africa.
It was a big thing in Africa. Exactly, but no one was talking about it in North America. Because I remember thinking, this is so odd. Why are you guys talking about this in South Africa? No one was talking about it here. It was a real eye-opener. They were so ahead of the curve thinking about these things. And I hadn't heard a single discussion about that. Definitely not at McMaster or anywhere in Ontario. So it blew me away.
That's interesting. And now thinking about your career, where you started and where you are now, what are you most proud of?
Oh God, so many things. I would say definitely I love, love, love when my graduate students or undergraduate students excel and achieve their full potential and are happy doing whatever they're doing. Like that is for me one of the happiest things. I love getting emails from students telling me, you know, thanks to you, or thanks for that letter or whatever. I'm now doing this and I'm so happy. Like I honestly love that. Like I would say for me, that's why one of my big achievements is that I've helped so many students achieve their full potential. And some of them in the face of adversity and in the face of professors telling them they will never graduate. So those are my big achievements, the ones where those students are now excelling and despite the odds. And then also I would say definitely the fact that my research is now finally doing what I wanted to dream to do as a teenager, which was do research with global impact, is finally happening through grit and perseverance and not letting those reviewers get me. Because many people have quit academia because of, you know, not getting grants funded and all those things. But I am passionate and determined, I think, in part because of my mom and my neighbor. And I think if you have a real passion and a purpose for doing your research, you will stick it out even when you're rejected. If there isn't something really pushing you to do the work, then it's sometimes a lot easier to quit. So the students definitely doing work with global impact now, and definitely seeing the changes at McMaster with respect to EDI and how far we've come from the year 2000 when I started. I know sometimes my friends and colleagues here feel that we're not doing enough. But having gone to other universities, visited other universities, or chatted with people at other universities, McMaster is actually way ahead of many universities from an EDI perspective. And I think that was built on a foundation of Dr. Gary Warner, and who, you know, really instilled that sense 50 plus years ago. And we've built on that foundation and basically built relationships with our senior leaders in a way that they trust us and our opinions. And they have begun to weave EDI into their personal DNA and how they do things. So I would say that's definitely something I'm proud of compared to other universities. Like, I feel like our senior leaders get it, even though sometimes people might be upset about decisions they make. I think they do get it. They do care. And sometimes they have to make difficult choices. That doesn't mean they don't care. So yeah, I would say those are my three major things I'm proud of.
So thank you. Phenomenal. You know, it's amazing to be in studio with you at this time. Thank you so much for sharing. I wanted to ask you, you know, about being a woman in academia, but also importantly about your work co-founding ACFEM.
That was built on the lots of hard work and loneliness of Dr. Gary Warner. I mean, he started in 1967. I think for a long time, he was the only Black professor at the university. And then there are a couple others that I know that when I got here, there were a couple others. There was Dr. Colin Nurse. Fredo Fosu, right, was in chemistry. And then there was Robert James, who wasn't a professor, but he was the head of all the biochemistry labs for over 25, 30 years. And he was also a fantastic mentor to me when I first started, actually, really helpful for me running my lab and even setting up my lab. And there was, I think, Jamal Dean came a couple years after I started, Dr. Patricia Danzer, who was a social work professor. And so they laid the foundation. And then, so I got here in 2000, so there weren't that many of us. But, you know, I think Gary was doing, I would say, a lot of the work and the advocacy at that time, and gradually started roping me in as he was doing some of this work. And definitely, I think 2006 or 7 was when Bonnie Ibawa joined McMaster. And then we started meeting regularly, the few Black professors, and started dreaming of having, you know, something like an association. But it was the impetus of the students, the undergrad students. There was some incidents happening in Hamilton and at McMaster, and the Black students needed support. And ACFAM literally was born out of that need to have something of an association where we could speak for the on behalf of the students, because they didn't have a lot of voice, and we did. So it was born out of that. So Kojo Damte was one of the regular student, I would say, co-founders of ACFAM. And Sally and her sister Yusra Musa, like they were like literally it was a student driven formation. And then we had a wonderful president at the time, Patrick Dean, who completely endorsed the formation of ACFAM. I think without his support, and I'm not sure that we would be here. He definitely got behind us as an association and came to all of our events initially.
And for the listener, what is ACFAM? What are some of the key achievements that ACFAM has been able to accomplish in all these years?
Yeah, so ACFAM is the African Caribbean Faculty Association of McMaster, so ACFAM, which I jokingly say sometimes stands for African Caribbean Family, or like we can come up with a whole kind of, so it stands for many things. But I like the African Caribbean Family for the acronym, as another acronym. I would say the most of our progress came, unfortunately, in 2020 when George Floyd was murdered. But prior to 2020, the 10 years between founding in 2010 and 2020, we were definitely meeting with senior leaders, as I said, building relationships, talking about challenges. President Dean, when he was president, whenever there was anything to do with anti-Black racism in Hamilton and the community wanted to speak with him and McMaster, he would always invite Bonnie and I to join those meetings to give our perspective to the community, but also to then help him understand the community. So I would say those first 10 years before George Floyd was murdered, we built relationships, really solid relationships with senior leaders at McMaster, as well as in the Hamilton community. And then I think when George Floyd was murdered, it then allowed us to rapidly respond and ask requests of our senior leaders that they were willing to accommodate, because they had already built those relationships with us. They knew where we stood on certain issues and values. And we weren't a group of strangers that suddenly appeared demanding initiatives or funding. And so definitely I would say having our Black Student Success Center, having the Black faculty cohort hire, you know, having our Black Student Mentorship Program, you know, we submitted 9 requests to the president and the provost in 2020 after George Floyd was killed, and all 9 have been initiated. Some have been completed because they were finite things, and others are going to be ongoing for years to come. And so I know Bonnie and I and those that helped write it are personally excited that we had already built such a strong foundation and relationship with our senior leaders that they engage us in these discussions and decisions throughout. And it wasn't a case of doing it for us without us. It was for us with us.
That's amazing. That's awesome. Thank you so much for sharing. Very briefly, I just wanted to get your thoughts, you know, on your current work on the Canada Caribbean Institute. You know, what do you do in your role as strategic advisor to the president?
So in my role, I'm supposed to advise him and, you know, just make him aware of the context in the Caribbean as it pertains to Canada and vice versa. Right now, my primary focus is planning the 3rd annual conference research symposium. It's going to be the first in Canada. The first two were in the Caribbean. One first was in Jamaica. The second was in Barbados. But this is going to be the first one in Canada, 3rd annual, but first in Canada. And the president chose the theme of climate crisis, resilience, and alternative energy sources. So that's what I've been working on. The biggest challenge is it's summer and no one wants to work. So the biggest challenge is getting people to respond to emails, to schedule meetings. But our administrative coordinator, Andrea, and I are doing our best to get as much done with as few hands or as many hands as we can. So we're trying to get more hands on deck so that everyone can still enjoy their summer holiday, but the planning still moves forward so that we, McMaster, hosts an incredible conference on climate crisis. I know we will do it. And like, as I said, we're full of ideas. We don't lack ideas. We have some really cool potential keynote speakers lined up. We're just trying to see who's going to be available, accept our invitation. It's definitely a conference that you should encourage all of your listeners to come. Registration is free. So if you're in Ontario and you live nearby, it's free registration. And it's a chance to meet Caribbean and Canadian researchers who are passionate about the climate, and we all should be. And regardless of your research discipline, we're trying to make it as inclusive as possible. So even what are the climate impacts on, say, for example, even mobility, what are the climate impacts on arts and culture? Because we know that when money is scarce, the first things that get cut tend to be arts and culture. So there's opportunities for everyone to have an input and to be part of that dialogue about the ripple effects of the climate crisis, because it's not just about flooding and fire. Like, there are longer term ripple effects that will be traced back to the climate impacts. Yeah. Climate impacts on our health. Like, it's not just respiratory health. It's also going to be impacting things like diabetes and cardiovascular disease. Like, we're trying to make it as wholesome as possible so that as many people that are passionate about the climate crisis in general can come and participate, listen, learn. Because again, looking at things from different perspectives is how we get that innovative, outside the box thinking and solution.
That is all we had in this episode.
Join us next time.
And be sure to follow us on our various social media platforms. The Black Professors Podcast was established in the summer of 2023 as a space to share the often untold stories by Black professors who take us behind the scenes of their career trajectories. The co-executive producers of the Black Professors Podcast are
Dr. Selina Mudavanu, Communication Studies and Media Arts Department, McMaster University,
and Dr. Motilola Akinfemisoye Adejare, African Studies Program, University of Calgary. The production team includes undergraduate and graduate students.
The title of the track used in the podcast is Podcast Hip Hop Intro Short by Corporate Sounds, accessed via Jamendo. Our sincere gratitude to the Pulse Lab at McMaster University for graciously allowing us to use the podcast recording equipment. The Black Professors Podcast is supported by generous funding from McMaster University's Arts Research Board.